We welcome you to a conversation among an Episcopalian minister, a university biology professor, Darwin impersonator Brian Ellis, and you, the audience, to explore some of the history, theology, and science behind the controversy stirred up by Charles Darwin. After introductory comments, our panelists will respond to questions from the audience. Father Jack Stapleton is a 1974 graduate of Transylvania University and is currently the rector at Trinity Episcopal Church in Greeley. Dr. Rob Reinsvold is an assistant professor of biological sciences at the University of Northern Colorado. He specializes in fungal biology and evolution. Dr. Reinsvold also coordinates secondary science education. Brian Fox Ellis is an internationally renowned storyteller, educator, and naturalist, and the author of 12 books, including an adaptation of his performance, Charles Darwin and His Revolutionary Idea.
An Anglican priest.
And a biology professor.
And Charles Darwin
walk into a bar.
Dot, dot, dot. You get to fill in the punchline. Well, I want to really begin by emphasizing that this is a dialogue, this is a conversation, this is not a debate. And one of the primary goals of the Humanities Council that we hope we are fulfilling this morning with your help is to encourage civil discussions and civility in particular among differing points of view. And so I want to open by really focusing on where religion and science overlap. And quote a little bit of Darwin and my opinions, and then challenge you to think about where does religion and science overlap for you? Where do those two places, those two ideas feel comfortable in your belief system? To begin with, I wrote this show about Darwin so that you get to hear what Darwin said. Because as you well know, in this uncivil debate, the shout fest that we often hear, that there's a lot of he said, she said, he, she might have said. And so, you know, the performance you heard the other night and the book is 80 or 90% Darwin. This is what he said. And there are a lot of things that are often left out of the debate on both extremes. If you think about it, a very small percentage on each extreme has dominated the conversation. And most of us are somewhere in the middle. And we can get along. We can agree on a lot more than what we disagree on. So where do those ideas overlap? Three things you might have heard in the performance. Darwin studied for the clergy. Not just studied, but received a degree at the top of his class in training to be a minister. When he traveled around the globe, he could only take a few things with him. And for him, one of the most important things he took was the Bible. And not the good King James Version that I held up the other evening, but a Gutenberg Bible. Because he had already memorized the Bible forward and back. And he wanted to translate German so he could learn German because he had already memorized the Bible. Think about that. And then in the end, when he published, he would not publish anything that would offend his wife. And his wife was the most fundamentalist person you could imagine. As I joked in the Q&A, imagine right now your most fundamentalist friend. Put Emma Wedgwood to the right of her, or him. When they first were dating and got married, she was uncomfortable with some of his ideas. Once the book was published, or before it was published, before he would publish, he wanted to make sure it was okay with her. She read it. The next morning, he wakes up to see her at a bonfire out back. She comes in the house, and she actually gives him the book. It wasn't in the fire. And she said, and this is pretty much a paraphrase rather than a quote, she felt like he was doing God's work, you know, helping us to understand the miracle of creation. I'm trained as a biologist. I know as a scientist that science is about asking good questions with measurable results. You know, faith and religion is another way of thinking. But I do believe, I went on a bird hike this morning with Dick Maxfield, and as we're walking along the Poudre River and that wonderful trail system that you folks have helped to create, you should all give yourself a pat on the back about that. It's a really wonderful trail system. You know, and we saw all these really great birds. We saw an osprey circling above the pond. We saw eastern and western kingbirds. Wait a minute, eastern and western kingbirds. I saw evolution right there. And how these different birds who live in slightly different habitats, as they've expanded their range, have adapted to different food supplies and different environmental conditions. So now the kingbird has an eastern and a western species. But here they overlap. And you actually get to see both of them side by side hawking for insects as tyrant flycatchers. And so, A, evolution is everywhere you look. And B, I don't think that we need to argue so much. I think that there's a lot of common ground between religion. And when I'm in the wild world, admittedly, that's my religion. You know, when I'm walking down a trail, when I'm breathing the fresh air, everyone please indulge me, take a deep breath. What you just breathed in was inside the person next to you a couple moments ago. And to quote Walt Whitman, who I'll be later tomorrow evening, Every time I breathe in, I breathe the outside world into myself, with a capital S. Take another deep breath. What you just breathed in was in those trees a few moments ago. Say, thank you, trees. I mean, we exchange molecules constantly with the wild world around us. And to me, that's the miracle. That's just simply astounding. That what you just breathed in was inside your neighbor a few moments ago. And so I want to end this little introduction by challenging you. Think about it for a moment before we talk about it. Where do you feel most comfortable with that overlap of your spirituality or religion and science and the natural world? Where do your beliefs in science and religion overlap? Where are the places in your thought and your personal philosophy where those two things cohabitate comfortably? Think about that for a moment. And throughout the morning, we're going to do a lot of what educators call think, pair, share. So think about the question, find a partner, and share with each other. And throughout the morning, I'm going to encourage you to find different partners. You probably came with a buddy or a spouse or a sibling, or a child. you can talk to your buddy and you probably share the same idea. But I want to encourage you to share with people who might disagree with you, who might have a slightly different point of view, because you can learn more that way. So here's the question I want you to think about. Where does religion and science cohabitate in your philosophy? Where do religion and science overlap in your thinking? Next up, my new best friend, Father Jack. Let's see what he has to say.
Well, in that case, I'll begin with a demur. This morning, I represent only myself. As a person of faith, that means I speak as a Christian, as an Anglican, and as an ordained one, for that matter. If you are not familiar with Anglican, I will give you two quick definitions, one for my Protestant friends. Catholic light. All of the ritual with only a third of the guilt. But from my Roman Catholic friends, the definition goes like this. A person with one foot in Rome and another on a banana peel. Now, most every culture across the globe has a story or stories that explain first why and then how our world came into existence. These stories try to make sense of who we find ourselves to be. On the one hand, a creature who is manifestly a part of creation, sharing elements of common life. On the other hand, human beings have also felt a separation, an awareness that seems to set us apart from creation. We find ourselves to be resident aliens, creatures of Earth, yet stuck on the outside looking in like children pressing their faces up against the window of a candy store. In our culture, the best-known story of creation is one found in the Hebrew Scriptures. It begins with a formless void, and over a period of 6 days, God keeps saying, "Let there be." And there is. Light and dark, earth, sky, and seas, sun, moon, and stars, reptiles, mammals, and at the end, us. The story, by the way, is retold almost immediately. Set in a garden, and it comes to a rather bad end. Now, if we didn't have all the fossil records, if we didn't have all the variant species, if we didn't have the field of modern genetics, and even if we didn't have Charles Darwin, the stories of creation in our best-known form have some rather big holes for us to deal with. There is the problem of light appearing on the first day, but the sun, moon, and stars don't show up till day four. Later on, there's a problem of population. After all, Cain and Seth, the surviving children of Adam and Eve, did get married. To whom? I mean, they could possibly have married their own sisters, but a species that begins with that level of incest is bound to run into a few problems with its kids. And of course, there is the problem that has vexed theologians for centuries. Did Adam have a navel? Before we ever get to evolution and natural selection and all that goes with it, people of faith need to ask ourselves, do we really understand the Bible as well as we think? Over the centuries, brilliant minds have examined this collection of writings. They've gathered evidence, early manuscripts, archaeological research, historical research, cultural research, and then they've compared bits and pieces of the books with other bits and pieces of the book to find some inner consistency, and they've developed many fascinating theories in the world of biblical theology. And then, of course, new evidence does occasionally turn to light, and except for those who fall deeply in love with their own theories, it involves some recapitulation, some restatement of their understanding. In other words, biblical theology uses much the same methodology as science. Yet oftentimes people of faith are not willing to allow science to use our own methodology. We hear again and again that religion and the natural sciences are asking different questions, and that assertion is true. But the methods we use to answer our separate questions are remarkably similar. Although it would make a happier culture and happier school boards across the nation if we could just let each question have its own classroom, it doesn't really work that well. The discoveries and theories of each field often have implications for the other. Religious faith addresses the meaning of things, beginning with one overmastering assumption: things have meaning. Science tells us how life developed, but not how the life that developed is supposed to be lived. Science can tell us where we've come from and possibly predict where we might be going, but it cannot tell us if there is ultimate purpose behind that, some sort of glorious or horrific destiny. Science cannot tell us that because it doesn't ask the question. If that question ever becomes the primary question of science, then science is no longer science. It is philosophy or religion. Here again, I need to remind you that I am not a representative of religious belief in general, nor even a representative of the Christian faith of whatever expression. I'm just here as a Christian, and I am convinced that there is a God who is both the creator and sustainer of all that is, and that God thinks creation is very, very good. So what do I do with Mr. Darwin and his successors? In truth, I read them with interest and wonder. What Charles Darwin did was a prodigious feat. Thousands of samples of fossils, flora, and fauna gathered over many years, a lot of creative thought, and he was in no hurry. The voyage itself lasted 5 years. It took 3 years later to fully form the concept of natural selection, and then he waited and reflected and studied 20 years before he published Origin of the Species. Whatever else he might be, Darwin was a careful and meticulous man. I cannot fault him for his methodology, and I cannot fault him for his use of reason. So should I just ignore him and live in a hermetically sealed religious bubble? Is it possible for me and any person of faith to live at ease in both worlds? Can both worlds be fully embraced without intellectual dishonesty? St. Augustine was reputed to have said that God has spoken to humanity by means of two books, the book of Scripture and the book of nature, and that these two books always agree. And if the two appear in stark disagreement, then St. Augustine might well say, we've obviously misunderstood one or the other. Thanks to Mr. Darwin and his successor, like Professor Reinsvoll, we are in a world where the book of nature is being read again and again, and new chapters being written. As a person of faith, I've come to trust this reading of the book of nature. It has become a new tool in the search for understanding the purposes, methods, and character of the Creator. I think that we Christians have used the book of Scripture badly. I once had a lovely set of metal tools I got from my father's workshop. I used them, by the way, to chip paint off a door in a house that we were restoring. It had about 7 coats of paint, and so I used it to get into the little nooks and crevices. I used it to open cans of paint and to pound them shut again. And several years after that, my mother was intrigued to know I was doing some woodworking and said, you know, Jack Ward, your daddy had bought a really expensive set of precision German chisels. I wonder what happened to them. Oops. See, we use the book of Scripture as I use those chisels. It's long past time to return to the book of Scripture with the book of nature in hand and utilize our whole intellect in a new and better understanding of what God has been trying to tell us. Okay, question. If the book of Scripture and the book of nature always agree, then how do we need to read one so that our confusion about the other is resolved?
And now our esteemed biologist will take the floor.
You know, I'm going to have a lot of difficulties following these two already. When we chose who came first, who came second, who came third, I thought third would be easy because then everything was going to be set already, and so maybe that's going to be good for me.
Because you evolved.
Yeah, I evolved. I'm the omelet. Okay. The chicken and the egg and the omelet. Okay. So what I was asked to talk about and take the perspective from the scientific standpoint, and what I want to do, we 5 minutes, as you found, neither of us stayed with 5 minutes, neither they did already, and I probably won't either, but we'll try really hard. I want to first say, though, that it's been really amazing. What we wanted was to have a discussion. You have done that, so that is good. So I'll keep my points. I had notes, but I'm going to try to go away from those. And I want to talk about the nature of science briefly and then natural selection, since that's what we're really talking about. First, I want to make the point that among scientists, evolution and natural selection is not controversial. It's a accepted explanation for how the diversity of living organisms came to be. And it's fairly well accepted. Why then does it appear so controversial among the public? And that's part of what we have. And I think it, in part, and I deal with this with my students quite a bit. I talk with a lot of other people about this as well. And part of it is gets at that the nature of science and the nature of other ways of knowing. And most people accept that there is more than one way of knowing. Some people will accept that there's only one way of knowing and that's it. But most of us accept that there is multiple ways of knowing. And many of us, like I, feel that other ways of knowing complement science, as we've had here, and don't necessarily are not always in conflict. But in some people, it might be a way of seeing it as in conflict. But let me talk about the nature of science and what science does, and maybe part of the limitations of science as well. Science tries to understand the natural world and parts of the manufactured world. For example, the laws of gravity, and gravity applies just as much to artificial satellites as they do to stars and planets. Okay, so it works on that way. The other aspect of what science does is it's this interplay between observation and explanation about the natural or manufactured world. And that interplay, so first they go off, they make observations, collect information from observations and experiments, form explanations for how those systems work, pose other experiments or other makes other observations, refine those explanations, and constantly it's this reiterative process. Other thing about science is that it is a very communal activity. Scientists contribute to the body of knowledge, and they keep self-correcting each other. They keep adding. It really is kind of a challenge to a scientist. They like to find fault in other scientists. They really do. They would love to be able to find the fault in any explanation, because then they become famous themselves, and they are the ones that get the credit. So there always is then this, the body of science, how science advances, is there is this self-correcting nature to it, putting out more evidence. And does the evidence fit with the explanation, the prevailing explanation at the time? If it doesn't, that explanation gets refined. Or if at times, and we have this at times, every once in a while there's a shift in a way we look at the world. And that shift in the way we look at the world, and let me give you an example of one that is less controversial right now, but was in its day, is there was a time from the Greeks through the Middle Ages in which the predominant model of the solar system was Earth was in the center and everything revolved around us. Actually, I take it one step further, is I'm in the center of the universe and all of you revolve around me, but, you know, just teasing. But with Copernicus and Galileo, they start seeing that the evidence that they were collecting didn't fit that model, and it fit a better model in which the sun was in the center of the solar system, and the planets revolved around, and Earth being one of the planets revolved around. So that was a shift. Well, similarly happened with the natural selection and the idea of evolution. Up until that point, the prevailing view in Western society was fixed. The species were fairly fixed. They didn't change over time. It didn't quite fit what naturalists were seeing all over the world of the variety that we had and everything that was going on in there. And natural selection is actually the major contribution that Darwin provided. And it's a simple concept. It really is a simple concept. It's one of those that probably most scientists before them, once they understood it, they just said, duh. okay? And it is simple because it's all it is within a population, you start off with, there's a lot of variation within the population. Not all individuals in a population are the same. Okay. And much of that is genetically based. Those traits are genetically based. How that variation gets in there, now we know, is there's changes in that genetic base that occasionally get in there through mutations. So we constantly have an inflow of new traits in there, and then we have this variation. We also know, and this is a part of Darwin's argument too, is that natural populations produce more offspring than the habitat can produce or it can support. So there's this struggle for existence. Some of the members of a population are not going to make it to able to survive and reproduce. What Darwin saw then is those that had a slight advantage over their peers would have a greater chance of influencing future generations because they would reproduce. Next generation, there would be a greater proportion of them that would have that, those traits. And as time goes on, the population, not the individuals, the population evolves, changes over time. It becomes more individuals that have the trait that was selected for by the environment. And then the environment then becomes the selector. And that's all natural selection is. Now, the real power of that is to also see that those incremental changes is all you need. And if you do the math, and you can easily do it, if you have a 10% difference, an advantage, just 10% advantage over your peers, it only take, if you were only one in 100, it would only take 100 generations before that trait would be the predominant trait. Okay. And for organisms like mice, it might take less. For organisms like bacteria, that could be within a few days. And that is one of the powerful things now that we use as far as the applications of evolution to those of us that are concerned about health. Is we now have organisms that weren't pretty predominant before. We have a lot of these antibiotic-resistant staff that are out there, and hospitals are now filled with them. They weren't a couple decades back, okay? But that also means then that's one of the changes that we need to make to stay one step ahead of them in this arms battle that we're doing, because we've always been in that. And now we understand it more so we can be more prepared to deal with it. So, my question to you, why do you think evolution is more controversial in the common populace than other scientific theories, such as the theory of gravity or atomic theory of matter? Why do you think it is?
Yesterday I was Gregor Mendel, and Mendel was Augustinian, and Mendel loves to quote St. Augustine. And he says that knowledge is the key to unlocking the gates of wisdom. And the more we know, then the better choices we can make. And that knowledge is the key to unlocking the gates of wisdom. And, you know, I'm sad that you guys have already missed the best part of this panel discussion. And that was over a few beers the other day at Crabtree Brewery. I've learned so much from just hanging out with these guys the past couple of days. And while you were talking, we had our own little conversation up here and you know, listening to the professor talking about Galileo and gravity and Copernicus and how we used to think we were the center of the universe. And the Pope excommunicated Galileo for his ideas. And then 400 years later, he was pardoned. So Darwin still has 250 years to go. Because again, we'd like to think we are the peak of evolution. But I have problems with that idea. that I think that there are other animals who in other ways are more involved. We don't have the largest brain. We don't even have the most folds in our brain. I mean, look at elephants and whales and porpoises. Clearly, again, with a number of spectacles, we don't have the best eyes in the universe. And I personally believe that there's much we can learn reading the book of nature. I'm the only one without glasses on the panel. I didn't realize that. Sorry. I have great respect for my elders, and I've learned so much. Rubbing salt in, yes. So here's the last question we have of you, and kind of putting all of this together, and then we'll take a few questions. But here's a question. I'd like you, instead of just turning to a partner, maybe a group of three or four. But before you do that, I want you to formulate for yourself a number. Get a fixed number. And here's the number line. And really, this should be a three-dimensional sphere, but we're going to boil it down to a two-dimensional or one-dimensional line. 100% creationist, literal interpreter of the Bible, or 100% atheist, evolutionist, science has all of the answers. Where are you on that line? Well, it's 100% or 100%. So you're 25-75 or 35-65 or 65-35. Just take a moment and think about where are you, maybe closer to 50-50, 55-45, but where do you lean? Do you lean more towards the creation, Bible, God's hand involved in evolution? Or that, you know, God got the ball rolling and evolution is doing most of the work? Or, you know, where are you on that line? Take a moment and get a fixed number in your head. Religion is the first number. Science is the second. So I guess I would be more, I'd be more like 595, to be honest. Okay? So where are you? Get that number if you want to write it down to help you get it straight. While you're turning your seats around and we're pulling back into a large group, I will go ahead and actually apologize for the false dichotomy that I placed you within. Yes. And I knew what I was doing. It was a conscious choice. And I did give a little hint there that it really should be, you know, a multidimensional sphere of some sort. Because, you know, science and religion are just kind of two things that don't necessarily have to disagree. And that's the whole point of this. And, you know, Rob actually threw out, you know, when we're making decisions about nuclear versus wind power, science answers a lot of questions, but we need religion and ethics, but we also need economics, and we need to think about all kinds of other choices and ways of thinking and analyzing things before we make some of those tough choices. It really is a much more multi-dimensional realm. But here's the most important question, and I only need a showing of hands. If you would have done that number line before you came, and based on the conversation you just had with your new friends, how many of you think your position on that line is now a little different? Give yourself a pat on the back for having an open mind. The rest of you? So,
and you have just now been set up.
So we are going to open this to questions, and because we are recording, it is important we use the microphones. So Rob at one end, I at the other. If you have a question, come to one end. You can ask any one of us, or we might just jump in. But if you have a question directly for one of us, then ask that person. If you have a question, come to either end or down the middle, and we'll take turns on the microphones. Who has a question? Come on forward. Go ahead and line up at a microphone. If you have a question, come on down so we can transition question to question.
I don't know if this is a question. It's more of an observation. Before we had our conversation, we never actually talked about what is God.
All right. Where do I begin to tell the... has a goatee, right? No, sorry. Yeah, well, I saw one of the kids from our Sunday school in the grocery store who asked his mom if that was Jesus there shopping in the meat aisle. The problem, of course, is that the question of God can be answered in any number of different ways depending on your own background, the faith you grew up in. I will like to throw one issue in about the nature of God. Many religions, mine particularly, make some fairly defined statements about the nature of God and who God is. Those statements are either right or they're wrong, okay? If we are wrong, if we are wrong about a Trinitarian nature of God, about an incarnate God, then no matter how sincerely we believe, it's not going to change the nature of God, okay? On the other hand, if nobody in the world from this moment on ever believes a thing that is found in the Christian Nicene Creed, there may be universal consent, but that by itself doesn't make it untrue. The problem, of course, when you're dealing with God and what is God and what is the nature of God, is that the field of science, which might, under other questions, be able to provide remarkable answers, is actually hampered by the lack of the kind of evidence that it uses to make its decisions. So the answer to your question is there is no answer to your question.
Well, I'm reminded of a story. You know, I'm Salagir Cherokee, and I studied with Native elders for many years. And Ron Evans, a Cree Chippewa elder that I met a long, long time ago, was telling a story one time. When he was a little boy, he went hiking with his grandma in the Northern Rockies on one of those cold winter nights where there's no clouds. You can see all the stars, but it's so cold that snowflakes are appearing out of nowhere. And the snow's just falling out of a clear, starry sky, and the trees are covered with snow, and the world is covered with snow, and he's hiking through the woods with his grandma at night, and he asks his grandma, you know, who is Gitche Manitou? Who's this creator that you keep talking about? And his grandma said, look at all those stars, and you see those snowflakes, and you see the snow all around us. Now catch some of those snowflakes on your tongue. And he's running around and whirling around, and he said, Gitche Manitou is more than all of that and the feeling you have right now after spinning and whirling and chasing snowflakes on that cold night. So it really is indefinable and undescribable by its nature. Yet I think we reach for stories and, you know, the stories of the Bible or whatever tribe or belief you have. And those stories help us to begin to open our mind because we can't wrap our mind around it. But we can at least open our mind to those possibilities.
And from my standpoint, I'm going to agree with Jack that science as a whole, and I'm going to speak from science, can't speak towards the existence of a God or non-existence of a God. Can't say, and then by the same token, we can't say what the nature of God is in any way either. So it's just not a question we can answer because it's outside of the natural world by its very nature. So,
I think that my question goes along with what we're talking about in a maybe a definite way, and maybe it was a little bit controversial or here to say, but I'm going to ask you, panel, to comment on the fact that I'm going to say that man and science have to have something to create. I mean, they have to have a substance. They have to have substance and knowledge. They have to have something to create. And I'm going to say that unless you provide me evidence otherwise, God can create without material possession or having something in hand to create. Comment.
Well, we're actually running out of time because our next speaker is coming next. So if I don't know, I think that's a wonderful kind of more open-ended question and a good point to end because I hope, at least my favorite part, I can't speak for all of you, is the fact that the Chautauqua has opened this space and given us an opportunity to have an intelligent conversation and to think more deeply. And if that's what the humanities is all about, I think we succeeded in bold letters today. So give yourselves a round of applause. And keep the conversations going. I mean, I think the fine art of conversation is an art that we need to revive. And it is about deep thinking and asking tough questions and taking time with people that may or may not agree with you and agreeing to disagree if that's the issue at hand.